Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Musical notes to celebrate the month of the Rosary. Some very personal witnesses affording us an unusual glimpse of Pope Pius XII. And spotlight on a recent book which explains the sacrament of reconciliation. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As I just said a moment ago, October is the month of the Rosary. That's something we all know. More ambitious, perhaps, is to put one of the mysteries of the Rosary to music. But that's exactly what music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore has done for us. So stay tuned as he shares with us a programme focusing on the first joyful mystery.
As we pray the Rosary, we're invited to meditate on the particular scene that the mystery evokes and to enter deeply into it as we recite the Our Father, the Hail Marys, and the Gloria Patri. Sometimes art can help us to focus our minds prayerfully on the mystery. Sometimes music can help. Those words, Ave Maria, Gratia Plena, take us straight to the heart of the first joyful mystery, the Annunciation. I'm sure we all have our favourite paintings of the angel appearing to Mary, maybe the one by Leonardo da Vinci, or that breathtaking fresco by Fra Angelico in the Convento di San Marco in Florence. But there are plenty of musical images too. For one thing, of course, there are lots of settings of the Ave Maria, bringing us the angel's greeting in song. Ave Maria, gratia plena. Then again, you'll often find composers telling the story of the Annunciation, as in this famous medieval English carol, Angelus ad Virginem subintrans in conclave.
Angelus ad Virginem subintrans in conclave.
The setting I've chosen to concentrate on today is different again. It's a modern piece by the living English composer John Taverner, a member of the Orthodox Church. He wrote this piece in 1992, and it's for two unaccompanied choirs. The larger choir represents the angel, and the smaller choir represents Mary, overawed and trembling, repeating at regular intervals the same phrase, "How shall this be, seeing I know not a man?" The piece works best if the two choirs are in different locations, so that you get the dramatic effect of the dialogue between Mary and the angel. The first time I heard it was in Westminster Cathedral in 1995, when John Taverner himself gave a lecture about sacred music, and it was illustrated by some of his own works sung by the cathedral choir. When they sang his Annunciation, the small choir representing Mary was in the Lady Chapel, while the large choir sang from the sanctuary. The effect was stunning. The music has a prayerful quality that's hard to describe, but you can tell it's the fruit of profound meditation on the part of the composer. It draws the listener into a deeper contemplation of the mystery too. I'd like to leave you with what, for me, is the most sublime passage of all, as we hear the angels sing, "Blessed art thou among women." Blessed indeed.
A big thank you there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore for sharing with us his musical expertise. Monsignor Whitmore is a music historian, currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Now, on a different note, as announced earlier, I'd like to step back in time for a moment, sharing with you in a very personal manner some recollections of a Pope of the 20th century, one almost always spoken of in the media as the wartime Pope. He's Pius XII, Eugenio Pacelli, who was elected to the See of Peter in 1939 and who died on October the 10th, 1958, almost 50 years ago. Stay tuned, as in a few moments I'll be sharing with you the personal witness of some of those who knew him.
Traditional English way. Happy birthday to you.
On March the 2nd, 1956, children from all over the world gathered in the Vatican to wish Pius XII a happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you.
The United States of America have sent you wishes for your happy birthday, and may you blow out many more candles in the future.
A wish that was unlikely to come true. The Pope had just turned 80, and he'd already miraculously survived at least one severe illness.
When, in 1954, he was very, very ill with that, I don't know, that infection of the glands. He had those fits.
Father John Charleroux, a personal friend of Pius XII.
He was very, very, very ill. And the dean of the College of Cardinals, who was Cardinal Tisserand in those times, another Eugene, had told him one evening that it was time to ask for the last sacrament. It seems it was in his functions to warn the Pope, to inform the Pope of his opinion on that side. So the Pope had promised that the following day he would call in, I can't remember, the great penitentiary or the person appropriate for that kind of office. And then the following day passed, and the Cardinal Eugène Tisserand noticed that nothing had happened. So that the following time he saw the Pope, he reproached him. He said, but you promised and you didn't do it. Tisserand told me the story himself. And the Pope replied rather shyly, well, I had promised you and I was ready to keep my promise. But, you know, during the night, somebody came and told me that wasn't the case yet, and that I had still 4 years to bear the crown of thorns. He used to call the mite of the child of the crown of thorns. And he died 4 years later. But the Sister Pasquarina noted in that night that at that same moment she was woken up and an extraordinary light that had appeared in her window in the Vatican.
Pius XII did live another 4 years, and on October the 9th, 1958, Vatican Radio broadcast this announcement.
This is the Vatican Radio, broadcasting in English. With heart heavy with sorrow, we give the following announcement. His Holiness Pope Pius XII is dead. He quietly expired at 3:51 a.m. Pius XII, the man most highly esteemed and venerated in the world in this century.
When the Pope died, his great nephew, also called Eugenio Pacelli, was a little boy.
And I remember especially when he died in 1958, because he died in Castel Gandolfo. It was the end of the summer period. And his coffin was brought by car to Piazza San Giovanni in Laterano.
Yes.
And that's where the cortege was formed. It was a cortege which lasted about 1 hour, 1 hour and a half. And the streets in Rome were crowded with people from, you know, all classes.
The exceptional silence that falls on Rome on those occasions, and that near the Tiber, I think near when they reached near Castel Sant'Angelo, through that silence, there was one feminine voice that rose. When that she threw, I couldn't spot where it came from. And it was one woman who cried out, "Come questo Papa non ci sarà mai." And it had the impression of the voice of Providence.
There will never be another pope like this one. The cry of that woman may have given voice to the silent grief of the Roman people mourning their beloved pontiff. But the Romans were not the only ones to grieve Pius XII. American Cardinal William Wakefield Baum had met Pius XII as a young seminarian and recalled the lasting effect this encounter had on him.
So Pope Pius XII, this great figure who had made such an impression upon all of us, with great kindness and gentleness spoke to each one of us. We were then seminarians, but he knew we were future priests, so he took the time to say a few words of encouragement to each of the seminarians there present and to give each one his special blessing. That was for me a very beautiful moment, and it had a permanent effect upon my life to encounter this great pontiff and to receive those words of kindness and encouragement That's a personal memory I have that's very precious to me. Pius XII was a man who shaped us. I've often thought of his great encyclicals, which were the prelude to the Second Vatican Council.
What about the more human side to him? Because he comes across as an austere figure, doesn't he, physically?
Well, he had a very impressive bearing. He was a great presence. I think all of us who ever were in his presence were very much affected by that. But he also had great gentleness in his personal dealings. I know that from my own brief experience, but I know that from many of those who worked with the Holy Father during those years. He was the soul of kindness and gentleness. He had that regal, majestic appearance, but truly a most gentle pastor in his personal relationships.
Pius XII was absolutely it for us.
Sister Kathleen England came to Rome as a children's governess and later entered the Ursuline religious order.
In my congregation, the idea was, years ago, that everything descended from the top and you just had to sit at the bottom and receive it. And the Pope Pius XII was the great man. Huh? And he had a presence and a look in his eye which I thought absolutely marvellous. And it was.
Well, I came to Rome for a short visit in 1948 and had an audience. And he was carried in the sedia gestatoria.
Sir John Leslie was a young aristocrat who'd converted to Catholicism and was visiting Rome for the first time.
And it was very interesting, really, because I got fairly near the front, and I suppose there were about 3,000 people or so in the great hall of the Benedictines. And as he went out, he kind of waved and talked to a few people in the front. And quite definitely, he looked up and our eyes met like that. And I remember these piercing black eyes. And undoubtedly, it seemed to say, oh, well, and there you are, as it were.
He seemed to look through you to the end of your destiny. He had an extraordinary way of looking you straight in the eyes. And you had the impression that your whole life was seen by him from its beginning to its end, as it.
Father Charles Leroux was frequently in the company of Pius XII and witnessed what he described as a tangible spiritual hold the Pope exercised over people, Catholics and non-Catholics alike.
And he spoke with him sometime. As soon as he began speaking, there was an extraordinary atmosphere that entered that room. And when he gave his personal blessing to that little Asiatic priest, all the others, one a good Anglican, the others, I suppose, Lucian, everybody fell on their knees. And it was very much, the vicar of Christ and a martyr. It had already been, that. I suppose that's the impression that people had. It was, his presence transposed everything on a higher level. I know three people who were converted on sight and not candid little ninnies.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that feature focusing in a very personal manner on the figure of Pope Pius XII. And moving on in the broadcast, yet another change of tone, as we shine the spotlight on a sacrament, that of reconciliation, one which has become increasingly unpopular in the Western world over the past 40 years. That's if we believe in the data collected regarding it. Or anyway, in the United States, where it seems, in fact, that in 1965, the number of American Catholics who went to confession once a month was just under 40%. And by the mid-1980s, that number had dropped to only 6%. So one asks oneself, are there any reasons as to why this happened, why this sacrament has been dropped by many in recent years? And again, is anything being done to try to stop confessional boxes collecting dust? In an effort to find out more, Susie Hodges picks up that story by speaking to an Australian priest who's trying to correct this trend by helping Catholics rediscover the value of confession. He's the Director of Vocations for the Archdiocese of Sydney, Australia, Father Michael de Stoop, and has just written two books entitled The Gift of Confession, one a longer version and the other an abridged edition in question and answer format. He began by telling Susie what prompted him to write these books in the first place.
I guess the main objective is to convince the reader that the benefits of confession are many, they're striking and genuine, and to describe them in ways that the reader can readily understand and relate to. And what inspired me to take this particular angle on the book is that I think most people are quite familiar with what the sacrament takes away, namely sin, but I'm pretty convinced that many people in their approach to the sacrament are perhaps less mindful of the particular benefits that we receive from it, like the benefits that the sacrament gives us, rather than the things that it takes away.
Do you think that many people see confession as something to be dreaded, or as you put it, the spiritual equivalent of going to the dentist?
Yeah, well, I suppose I was using imagery there, that I think most people, they cringe before they go to the dentist. They're worried about perhaps what treatment they may need to receive. And given that I've tried to highlight, 25 benefits that we receive from the sacrament of reconciliation, I'm sure that, on the contrary, it's something that we even have good reason to look forward to.
But apart from, as I say, this dread of going there, why do you think, in more general terms, that the sacrament of reconciliation or confession has become so much less popular in recent decades? What are the reasons for that?
I don't think it would be put down to simply the difficulties of, confessing sins and that kind of thing. I think it can also be put down to a number of other things too. And I think that the fast pace in which people live their lives, I think it's become the life today too. We find it's not just the sacrament of reconciliation, but all the sacraments across the board are less frequently received. And it's not so much a crisis of any one particular sacrament, but the faith life in general.
But if you were trying to persuade somebody who was a bit reluctant what a good and genuine confession can do, the positive things, what would be those that you would list first?
Good question. I think the ones that I would list first is that it provides us with a personal encounter with Christ, and that some people would might say, oh, well, I can just tell God I'm sorry in my own prayer, and but I think that it misses that opportunity to be able to encounter Christ in such a way that it helps us to see ourselves more in relation to his capacity to forgive than our own personal sense of failure. And I think that can be a very uplifting and a helpful thing, to be able to encounter Christ in such a personal way.
Presumably there's also the helpful thing that it can alleviate guilt about sins and misdemeanours. That too must be relief.
Yeah, well, just as if, like a pus that builds up in a wound, is going to cause more pain if it's not released, or that kind of thing. If we're carrying around the weight of our misdeeds, there's nothing like the peace of soul that comes from being able to know that that those things don't stand between ourselves and God anymore.
When it comes to being on the other side of the grill, as it were, what emotions do you feel as a priest when you hear people's confessions?
That's something which I included in the book, and I think that there are many anxieties that people experience when they go to confession. They're probably thinking, well, what does the priest think of me if I confess this or that sin, And but certainly, if only people knew just how humbling it is for the priest to hear confessions, they certainly wouldn't be so anxious. I think that the more trust and confidence that the penitent entrusts in the priest and in the sacrament itself, the more indeed that the priest is able to feel Christ, filling his shoes. And it's a humbling thing that we're used as an instrument as such to bring Christ and his forgiveness to them.
Is it sometimes depressing, though, when you hear people confess really bad sins?
No, on the contrary, because I think that the priest takes delight in the new you, not the old you. And in as much as it's a confession of sin, it's also a confession of faith that this person is obviously identifying areas of struggle, but insofar as they're doing that, they're also identifying those areas in which they wish to grow. And of course, that's a great boost to morale, really. It's very encouraging and inspiring to hear people trying to aspire to to a life which is more pleasing to our Lord, yeah.
And what further measures, you know, your book is obviously one, but what further measures do you believe the Church could take to help persuade the faithful to return to a wider practice of the sacrament of reconciliation, say similar to a level that existed before the Second Vatican Council?
Yeah, yeah, I know it used to be a practice of the past. It perhaps still is in some areas, but I don't see it happening quite readily as much as perhaps it could be. And that is that I know in years gone by, parish priests in particular areas would swap parishes for, like, going from one confessional to another, just to give the parishioners a little bit of a variety, particularly given these days many lay people are working in a closer association with their parish priest, and they may be active in the works of the parish and have the natural inhibitions of being known by their own parish priest, particularly if they're working closely in association with him. And if a different parish priest from time to time is to be made available for confession in their parish, then perhaps we'd see more people taking avail of the sacrament that way, particularly given that it's you know, the traffic and the roads these days, it's more convenient to go to your own local parish.
What kind of feedback have you got so far from readers and the faithful to your book?
Yeah, I've had very positive feedback, particularly from young people. Many of them have said, oh, all the anxieties that I've had have been lifted, and I've certainly made an effort in the book to help people to have reason to see that a lot of the anxieties that we do have, we don't necessarily need to have. And even if we do, having to see that there are so many positive things that we can look forward to receiving in the sacrament.
Is your book more pitched at the younger generation or for all ages?
It's pitched for all ages, but having said that, since I'm a chaplain for the Catholic Youth Services, I did have the easy comprehension of young people at heart in writing the book. In fact, I gave the book to around about 20 young people asking for their feedback. And anything that was sort of above their comprehension, I asked them to mark the pages as much as they like. And that helped me to make sure that I could pitch it at their level of young minds. But having said that, I think that it would be very helpful for all ages.
That was Susie Hodges speaking to the Director of Vocations for the Archdiocese of Sydney in Australia, Father Michael de Stoop. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.